Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. The Western returns to the big screen in another installment of Magnificent Seven. That's right, and we're going to be talking about it on today's Anatomy of Movie. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. The comic books may have the Fantastic Four, the Western may have the Magnificent Seven, but today you have the big three. Dimitri Panos, Marissa Serafini.
Hello.
And of course, I'm Phil Svitek. And a couple of things right off the bat. If you're just joining us for the first time, we assume that you've seen the movie, so therefore it's very spoiler-filled, because we'll talk about the various things. You can, of course, download our rundown. You just find it in the description. And that way you guys can follow along and see all the various notes that we have. Now, for those of you who are fans of Anatomy, I want to say something, and if you're a first-time listener, hopefully you're not necessarily bored by this. It feels good to reunite. If you guys are close fans, you know that we've been a little bit scattered, and that's not because of anyone's commitment to the show or anything, but unfortunately that's life's commitment to us, if you may. So it's not been, you know, like with our heroes, we've been dealing with a lot under very dire circumstances, and so I'm fortunate to have to say that, but damn, it feels good to be back.
It does, and it does feel good to be back. And hello, movie fans, and I've missed this, and I need to, again, we'll get into talking movies, but just allow me this. If you have watched Anatomy of a Movie, I haven't been here for a while. And I haven't been with you fine folk. The Magnificent Three. I like Magnificent Three better than the Big... Come on, Phil.
That's basketball term, the Big Three. The Boston Celtics, come on.
It's been a while. And as my friends and my family, extended family, you know, suffered some personal tragedy. But you folks are there to help me stay standing. And I thank you. Phil, Marissa, John, who's not here, the rest of Anatomy of a Movie and Popcorn Talk Network, and Maria and Kevin. I wanted to thank you all, and thank you for allowing me to come back. It's a privilege to sit in this chair to be able to do this. I've always believed in that. To talk about movies has always been a passion of mine. I've done it for a little while, and to sit here in this chair is truly a privilege, and for you to allow me to come back means a lot to me, so... With that said, let's talk Magnificent Seven and Westerns.
That's right. Overall thoughts. Why don't we start with the ladies first? Marissa.
Magnificent Seven. Phil made me watch this. And I said,
way to start off.
Did he put a gun to your head?
He might have. First of all, I'll just preface all of this, but I'm not the biggest knowledgeable person on the Western genre, so I wasn't rushing to go see this film, but I saw it and I can see why so many people enjoyed it. There was fun moments, there was a lot of jokes, there was a lot of action, and I saw it more as an action kind of movie rather than a Western kind of movie. Mm-hmm. But overall, I walked away and I was, you know, thoroughly entertained, and I didn't hate it. I'll just say that person who doesn't watch a lot of Westerns as normal, I watched this and, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed it at the end.
Sure.
And what about you, Dimitri?
You know, there's a saying about, you know, when you're making multiple copies of something and the more copies you make, the quantity gets a little bit diluted. And that's sort of kind of what I felt with this movie. Anton Fuqua's remake of a remake sort of kind of dilutes the nobility and the theme of the first remake, the 1960 Magnificent Seven. And I sort of kind of got the feel that they made this for the mass market audience, which there's nothing wrong with that, with the exception that, you know, I think the mass market audience might just want a little more just out of movies. And when you look at what Quentin Tarantino has done to the Western recently by turning it on his heel, Django Unchained, Hateful Eight sort of thing, those movies did really well. And they reinvented, in a sense. It's Quentin Tarantino's version of a Western and or history. But audiences went. And I think that if you kept to Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai, which 1960s version Magnificent Seven was based on, a little bit more. I think audiences could get that too. But my biggest problem, I guess, is that it tying in our lead character, Denzel Washington, and having him have history with the bad guy sort of kind of dilutes the nobility of what the Magnificent Seven were. They were doing it because it was the right thing to do, where ultimately this movie falls upon, this is a revenge movie. Mm-hmm. By giving that character history with the bad guy. And it sort of dilutes the nobility and the cause for me. And that, to me, was a big thing. Now, with that said, you know, it was beautifully shot. Fuqua obviously studied his Western movie history because the stunts in this movie were great. The horse stunts were amazing. And the gunfights were just fun to watch. But yet, even with that said, you could see similar stuff. Watch the movie Silverado, directed by Lawrence Kasdan, you know, and you'll get the same thing, but you'll get it like a really good Western kind of a story. I just wish that Magnificent Seven, the 1960 version, you know, it was about damaged heroes who try to become noble men whose motivation comes from doing what is right as opposed to seeking revenge, with this version just ultimately boiled down to.
Well, I think that's, me. I mean, you know, a lot of what, like, you take High Noon, you take a movie, like, that was all about, I mean, we were trying to instill good values in a sense. Like, that's what the Western was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think we've changed as a culture in general. Unforgiven was kind of perhaps the start of where it was like, okay, maybe your hero is actually bad and he's starting to be the anti-hero. And now with shows like, you know, Sopranos, Breaking Bad, and so forth, like, the line's blurred, and I think that's just culturally where we're at. So I don't necessarily mind that portion of it. And I did enjoy it overall, and the problem is I feel like I would have enjoyed it a lot more if I didn't have a Western history. It didn't, you know, in the grand landscape, perhaps pun intended, of Westerns, it didn't necessarily bring something newer to the table.
Yeah.
You know, the storytelling, you know, it's one of those things, like, I can't really fault the writing. I thought everything worked well. Things were motivated. It just wasn't something newer.
It was very boilerplate-ish.
Yeah.
It was very, like I said, it was strictly, to me anyways, it just felt it was going for the mass market audience. And it didn't try to bring anything, like you said, new to the table. You know, the performances were fine. Again, I will say this. The other thing this movie, for me at least, lacked was it sort of kind of lacked the cool factor. It's undeniable when you if you watch the 1960 version that Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen have a cool factor on screen where they don't really have to do a whole hell of a lot of anything other than strike a match in the sole of their boot to light a cigar. Or it was just the way that they would ride into town. Denzel, who's a very strong actor, he's a great actor, don't get me wrong, but he didn't have that cool factor, so to speak. Like, when he was in The Equalizer, he was a badass. He was a force to be reckoned with. Yul Brynner in the 1960s version proved to be a force to be reckoned with, and when you put him with Steve McQueen, who was the ultimate of cool, the Pratt-Washington chemistry, albeit I felt it was good, but it didn't have that. They had to act to get the cool factor. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, in terms of Chris Pratt, I feel like he was underutilized because he's such a funny guy. Mm-hmm. And I felt he could have brought a lot more of that. So I don't know if that necessarily defines him as cool, but I did feel like if you're going to cast him, he was slightly underutilized as Chris Pratt.
See, I didn't think Denzel Washington was going for cool. I think his character was more so just a presence and not to be reckoned with. And I physically didn't look very, you know, menacing. He just looked very authoritative.
Yeah, like, don't confuse, like, I get what you're saying. Like, don't confuse, like trying to be cool. Like, Steve McQueen didn't have to try. He just was. He was a presence on screen. Not unlike Humphrey Bogart, and I know I'm going back to classic. Not unlike Harrison Ford. You know, I mean, these people had a presence on screen, and albeit Denzel can have that.
I mean, Training Day, that's...
Please. I mean, absolutely. He didn't have that for me in Magnificent Seven. In Yul Brynner, there was just something about him. the way he rode his horse and even the way he held his gun, there was like, he didn't have to act cool. It was just, that's the way they were. Yeah. You know, they had this presence, and I felt that Denzel, albeit he was good, I wanted more. I did want more of that.
Okay, so since we're on that, right, we'll kind of backtrack a little bit, but might as well talk about Denzel for a little bit. It's his first Western.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? I mean, is there just a different art form to performing a Western? Like, I mean, Clint Eastwood, how many has he done? He just has that presence.
He's another one, absolutely.
You know, and so when you just kind of look at him, it's the rough look, the face. Obviously, he doesn't talk a lot necessarily.
Yeah, I think it was, like, facial expressions, the way he carried himself, especially how he walked, and, like, the setup before he would draw his gun, I think, added to, you know, the physical body language
mm-hmm.
that would translate as presence and mm-hmm. coolness, I guess.
Yeah. No, but you're right. I mean, you bring up somebody like a Clint Eastwood. Again, he was somebody that, again, just the way he would wear his hat and light his cigarillo... It there was just something about it. And Denzel is being Denzel, you know, popular actor, very good actor. I don't think he was misplaced. He didn't look like a fish out of water. We know he can carry himself, and we know that he looks good as a carrying a gun into a shotgun just from his other movies, right? Mm-hmm. And that sometimes is a big mistake in when they cast somebody. If the person doesn't look comfortable holding that tool, that prop, then there's a disbelief if they look uncomfortable doing it. He doesn't. He looked very comfortable on a horse, and there was even a good camaraderie. But again, I'm just going back. Maybe it's more nostalgia for me. I don't know.
Well, it's also true. He didn't grow up on Westerns. Like, you right. know what I mean? So I think his learning curve to understand how this works, like, although be it a great actor, he had to learn a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when you talk about the Western genre, I mean, that it's huge. Yeah. It's riddled with history and minutia, and maybe he just didn't have the time. I don't know. Again, I'm not faulting his necessary performance. Nope. I think he also didn't watch Magnificent Seven because he specifically chose not to be tainted by that performance mm-hmm. and just do his own. But yeah, I mean, I'm just pointing these things out as perhaps that's why.
Yeah, maybe. And again, I didn't hate him. I didn't think he was miserable at all, and not by any stretch of the means. And like I said earlier, I didn't feel he was a fish out of water. I didn't think he was miscast in doing this. He was fine. There was just that certain panache that was sort of missing, at least for me. And if you'll allow, you know, I wanted to talk about, you know, the Western keeps on coming back, which to me is really great. You know, I love the Western, but, you know, I want to do my TCM Ben Mankiewicz, you know, moment, because, you know, I think that the Western in American cinema, you know, has contributed so much to cinema and beyond, and where it's influenced other genres. And the Western has been around since the silent era of film, because they were easy to film. Your main actors, like Tom Mix, like, they could do their own stunts on the horse. They were very cheap to do. And for the audience, they were great entertainment. Good guys wore white. The bad guys wore black. You knew who was good and
bad. And it's the story of America.
It was the story of America. And hence, you know, and that's the reason why they did it in black and white, so that the audience could visually see and root for the good guys. And there were great stunts. So they entertained an audience when film was learning how to stand, so to speak. And then, you know, Western sort of kind of, as talkies came more into play, then there are other genres that were coming and still in the limelight. And it was literally about 1939 that this movie called Stagecoach came out, and it starred who is probably one of the greatest cowboys, or known as being one of the greatest larger-than-life cowboy heroes, John Wayne, right? And that revitalized the Western again. And again, Westerns were cheap. They were called oaters because, you know, a lot of your actors were horses. So you fed them oats. And you could... They were cheaply done, but you had... It's still... You had great action. You had good storytelling. And then... And then something weird happened where television was invented and they're looking at programming. And since Westerns were so great and grand on the big screen, Westerns started to become popular on television. So you had great, you had Gunsmoke, Big Valley, Rawhide, which starred Clint Eastwood, Wanted Dead or Alive, which starred Steve McQueen. And that started to take away from the movie-going audience. And so right around that time, big screen competition with the little screen, they had to, if the Western was to survive in that era, they had to sort of kind of become a little edgier. That's how Sam Peckinpah comes into play. The Wild Bunch, The Magnificent Seven, some can argue that. That was the start of, we're going to go and just tell an action story. Like mm-hmm. you said, this is, you know, The Magnificent Seven, there's nobility involved, but ultimately, it's a Western action movie, you know? And so they had to become a little bit edgier. And, you know, and then today, when you look at what the Western has done, Quentin Tarantino, I mentioned, but look at some of the popular Westerns within the past, say, 10 years or so. They're remakes of other Westerns. You had 310 to Yuma, which it's a really solid remake, okay? True Grit.
That was a good one.
Again, a really solid remake of what is still a very solid original with John Wayne. You know, and now you have The Magnificent Seven. So it's great to me that the Western can survive and has survived, because I think that there could be good stories to be told. But like any genre, it has its hits and misses. The Lone Ranger wasn't particularly good. No. So, but that's a little brief history. And then I also, later on in the show, we'll talk about how The Magnificent Seven in 1962 and the Western just has permeated pop culture and has influenced like other genres. So, you know.
Well, why don't we take a quick step? So in terms of this, right? So it's technically the third, the second remake, the third movie. And, you know, dating back to all the way kind of, Fugo, he started getting involved in this back in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
So about 4 years, you know, at this point. And back then it was supposed to be Morgan Freeman, Kevin Costner, Matt Damon, Tom Cruise. And obviously it's kind of evolved since then. And when he got the call from MGM, he was kind of hesitant. He was nervous. He was like, I really want to do a Western. I've loved Westerns. However, I in particular love this one.
Mm-hmm.
So the last thing I need to be doing is messing it up.
Right.
But reluctantly, or maybe not, he went and did it.
Yeah.
But he wanted to stay really true to the full DNA of Sam.
And Tom Fuqua were talking.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you know, and I find it interesting, too, because the producer of this movie, Roger Birnbaum, who previously was the co-chairman and CEO of MGM, which released the 1960 version as well. It was just really funny. Like, he wanted to do a Western as well. And they were looking for product. There wasn't much in development. And to me, what's funny is instead of trying to maybe mine something original that might be out there, they went back into the MGM library to see, hey, what can we remake? So we always talk about the mentality of studio execs. So instead of trying to do something original, now let's go see what we have this vast library at MGM. Let's see what we can do. And he was a big fan of The Magnificent Seven, 1960. And he was also a big fan of The Seven Samurai, Akira Kurosawa. So, and there's a history there as well, too, which I just find so fascinating as to there's a mutual love between Seven Samurai and the 1960. And then this Magnificent Seven, there's a, you know, film rich history.
Which, by the way, makes me feel like, now that I think about it, just as a quick tangent, that all these people that are now executives mm-hmm. just grew up on movies and they're like, I want to make my own version of that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because of how much they love it. For no right. other reason than that. And it's like, yeah, maybe let's not let that be the reason.
Yeah.
But you got to give it to Fuqua. But, like, just already being a fan from the get-go. And, like, so you know that this was a passion project of his. It wasn't something that was really made for money. It seemed like it was a movie made for fun and entertainment.
Yeah, and again, his detail from production design and cinematography, it was beautiful. It looked like a Western, you know, and there's definitely something to be said about that, because if anything, your Western should not be claustrophobic. Your Western needs to be in the wide open of spaces. You know, that's one thing about Hateful Eight that I sort of kind of like. Everybody talked about the cinematography, but I'm like, it's in a room. Like, oh, the Western should be, I don't care if it's in a saloon at some point, but there's got to be something outside. I don't care if it's
a saloon. You have the windows and you see into, you know what I mean? Like, everywhere you look, there's something beyond the beyond.
Yeah, and there was so much said about Hateful Eight because it was actually filmed in 70 millimeter. I was like, who cares? It's in a room. Like, I want to see the vistas. I want to see the sunsets. I want to see the mountains. Like, I want that. I want to have, like, those are tropes of an American Western that make it so special, you know, to see them on a horizon with their horses going through a river. Like, you see these so commonly in Westerns, but it's what makes the Western rich in American culture.
Absolutely. Well, and one, you know, just also on production design, one thing, like, you always end up building the town.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's never, to my knowledge, been around, like, you can't just kind of be like, okay, we'll just put up a couple things. Like, no, you pretty much almost have to build the town, even though it may be hollow and whatnot, but that's what you have to end up doing in order to make it look good, and that's one of my favorite things.
But when you think about it, in this movie, they actually did build a town.
They did, absolutely.
And the buildings were not facades. You know, if you're not already here in California, and if you're coming out to visit and you are here in California and you've never done the Universal Studio Tour, I highly recommend it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a great tram tour, but it'll take you through quote-unquote Western town, where many Westerns were filmed with John Wayne. And you realize those buildings are facades. They were built specifically for the actors. You know, like John Wayne. The left side was where we filmed John Wayne coming out of a building, because we made our doorways a little bit smaller, so when he comes out, he's looking larger than life. On the right side, we made them a little bit bigger so that the woman would come out looking demure. And, you know, and so those were facades. And when you look at what they did in this movie, there were not just facades. They were actually working, like, you could walk inside the saloon and they would have the bar with the beverages and the glasses. I mean, the detail that Fuqua took. And I love it, too, because I would think you would have more control. You know, when you're filming an action sequence, you literally have more than just a virtual map. You have a map of your town as to how I'm going to choreograph, how the horses are going to go, where this person's going to jump from rooftop to rooftop. I found that the production design, Derek Hill did an amazing, amazing job at literally building Rose Creek from ground up.
And that, to me, that was part of the fun. They had a lot of sequences where things were happening, almost kind of like a montage, and you weren't explicitly told of what they're thinking. Later on, perhaps you were, but for the most part, you kind of had to get inside their mentality and be like, okay, well, he's staring out into something. Well, what is he looking at? What does that mean? And you start to figure out the pieces, and you're like, oh, that's what he's doing.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah, and apparently Hill was responsible for building 25 buildings, the church, the church,
and then they
burned the church down. And then they also had a fully functional livery stable as well. So everything was practical and real. You could open a cabinet and the cup was usable. This is coming from Sarsgaard, who is our villain. The whole thing felt lived in, and that's, I got that sense. I got that sense of the time period of which it was made. There was fantastic, amazing detail. And that's why maybe I didn't like the movie as much as I had hoped, but there were aspects of this movie, including the production design, that I thought were truly spectacular, and the cinematography and action as well.
Yeah. What about you, Marissa?
I liked all the buildings. It definitely was very believable as a small town.
Sure.
coming from someone who literally comes from a small town, I know what that's like. And I liked how there were those different shots during the action scene, which we'll get to, where you always see someone jumping from roof to roof, mm-hmm. or like actually utilizing the space of each building and going in and out of the windows and doors. Or you can see the different levels, or like someone's up top in the mezzanine and someone's down below. Right. And I think it looked beautiful. And knowing the fact that it was all practical and you could go into each set just shows how much detail that they really put into it. In the production, and you know, you just have to applaud them, because they used every space that they made, and it looked awesome.
Yeah, it was above and beyond just a set, you know. Mm-hmm. And I really did find that aspect very cool, very cool.
So let's talk about story, right? And we'll spend a little bit of time here. Overall, very simple story. I mean, there's Bartholomew, he slaughters people. We recruit, we get to the town, we take back the town, and then we fight for the town. And then we win the town. End of story.
End of story.
You know, but that's part of, you know, to me, Westerns have always been beautiful in the way they kind of, the intricacies of all of that. Mm-hmm. You know, the specifics of making that happen. And that's why I said, like, when they're really thinking, they're tinkering of, like, what they're going to do, that to me is the art form, not necessarily the story. But how does it compare to you know, for other Westerns? Well, Marissa, let's start with you, because you're the interesting one in the group, not having seen too many Westerns.
Well, I think I'm not going to compare it to other Westerns, but just the theme of the writing and just the simplest stories I do enjoy, because those themes still resonate today. Like, doesn't really have to be town, just replace it with something else. Like, knowing the idea that someone can be, like, walked all over by a certain person or certain group, and, like, your ego's hurt, and it's about that comeback kind of story.
Mm-hmm. I think more than your ego in this particular case.
Yeah, yeah. It was, like, families were torn apart and whatnot, but it's more so, like, going through a situation and coming back from it, and then like rising above it more so, mm-hmm. and like banding together, the whole idea of a community coming together. I think that's just admirable that people should still have in today's society.
You know, you said something at the top of the show that resonated. Like, you said you didn't feel as if you were watching a Western. And I find that regardless of the genre, if the movie is good enough, you should be able to plunk out that plot line, take it out of the Western and put it in a modern day cop movie, or take it out of the cop movie and put it into a science fiction movie, or take it out of that. Like, the story shouldn't be defined by the genre that it's in. It should just be a good story. The genre is more or less the setting that you hold. That's why I find Westerns to be equally as fascinating and interesting as a good science fiction movie. You know, they have, in a sense, similar tropes, but if you do them really well, right, you should be able to just plunk that story out and plug it into another movie, and that'll work. You know, that works wonderfully. So, you know, it was interesting to hear Marissa. It was interesting to hear you say at the top, I didn't really feel like I was watching a Western. I felt like I was watching an action movie. That, to me, is the sign that somebody was doing something sort of right.
Yeah, it was more so, it's like not a nag to Westerns. I got lost in the film and forgetting that it was a Western. And it has, like, Western has all of these expected tropes that you're looking for, and we got pretty much all of them. But at the end of it, you're just watching whatever's happening, despite whatever genre it is in.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I think part of it is you start to... They did a good job of making us fall in love with most of the seven, you know, if not all of them. It just kind of depends how you want to define it for yourself. And then the big switch, too, was they made the woman, Haley Bennett, a hero. By the way, she was also great in Hardcore Henry. We did that one, so check that one out. But I think that was a big step, you know, because that wasn't in the original.
No, it wasn't. But you know, another thing too, I wanted to go back. You know, what the Magnificent Seven started was, think about at its core, what's the Magnificent Seven? It's a bunch, but putting together a group of unlikely people that you wouldn't necessarily think would normally get along. You're putting them together to overcome, like, amazing odds and obstacles in front of them. Think about how many movies that's the basic plot line. Putting together a band of people to overcome these ridiculous odds. Like, even things like the Dirty Dozen. Like, that's instead of being the Magnificent Seven, they're the Dirty Dozen. But it's the same thing. It's like, and so what the Magnificent Seven has done for, you know, as far, or even the Seven Samurai to start off, but for American movies, it's a commonly used plot point of just putting together an unlikely group of heroes. The Suicide Squad. I mean,
and the Furious Seven.
Expendables.
Yeah. Expendables.
But here's the difference. They had to teach and trust the town.
True.
Which is a huge, you know what I mean? You don't see that often. It's one thing to put together a band together. True. It's a whole other thing to say, okay, now we need you guys. Like, you know, we're not going to be able to do this.
True. Yeah. So. Yeah, we need to build our own army.
Yeah.
You know, which
I
is,
liked that. That was cool. That was like a whole town coming together, you know, for the greater good.
Right. Right. And but again, it's a fun thing to toy around with, because how else are these guys going to, how else are our seven, or how else are our dozen? Like, how are you going to get through this if you don't try to, in one way, shape, or form, try to not only train your town, but you got to come up with other tricks, like building trenches, hiding in tents, and like.
I mean,
you know,
this is like the American Revolution.
Yeah,
this is the, you know what I mean. Like, in many sense, it's very allegorical of that.
Sure.
You know, you have your founding fathers, and then it's like, okay, well, the rest of you, yeah, you're farmers and whatnot, but let's go.
Yeah, and it was no mistake that this movie, this remake, was set not too long after the Civil War. Okay. You know, I mean, it. It resonates, especially when you have Denzel as your lead character, who has to like show his credentials. Mm-hmm. Every time he walks into a town, because everybody looks at him like Black Bart from Blazing Saddles, and he's like, "Listen, I'm a man of the law. This is my job. This is what I do. Here's my documents." He's got to do that everywhere he goes. And then there was like a little bit of PTSD with the Ethan Hawke character and such. So, you know,
they added that was very specific. They, you know, they liked the whole idea of Deer Hunter and Christopher Walken. And so like, why don't we use that now? That one, that version is a little bit more darker than this one. So sure. That one's the R-rated version.
Yeah. Literally. And that was like sort of what the Robert Vaughn character was going through in the 1960 version, as well.
It was interesting in terms of the cast too, you know, the way it's written, like, historically, people were very diverse. It's just the movies never portrayed that. So it's not that, you know, we have a skewed. It's basically saying, like, they didn't do it to be diverse just to be diverse. They're like, no, this is actually more historically accurate than what you know.
Sure.
And you're tainted by movies.
In a sense, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And. But, you know, the thing is, it's like, you know, we spend so much time on this diversity and everything, and I do get it, and I'm sensitive to the thing, but, you know, it didn't, you hire who's best for the job and who can pull the job off, right? Like, I can look at the 1960 Magnificent Seven and say, Yul Brynner doesn't look like your typical American cowboy, for sure. Neither does Charles Bronson. You know, Steve McQueen is your American, like, cowboy. And they, you know, and a lot of people will point to Eli Wallach as the bad guy. But there are a lot of Latin Americans who were in the original Magnificent Seven. You know, I don't think it was a complete 100%. I wouldn't call it, like, a whitewashing. But this movie did a great job. And the actors, regardless of their ethnicity, they brought it to the screen. Like, they were good. You hire the right person for the job, regardless of ethnicity. If they can pull it off, they pull it off. Zorba the Greek was played by Anthony Quinn, who is not Greek, but he's so iconic in that role. It doesn't matter. But I thought the cast really gelled for who they were, and I thought they worked. I thought they worked well together, and they had good presence on screen.
Yeah, I like the fact it was a very diverse cast. I think it's more the talent that can, like you were saying, it's the talent who can actually do embody each character. And I liked each of these individual, you know, seven for their own reasons. They mm-hmm. had all their special skills that we were rooting for, and they enjoyed, and their different personalities of how they approach and gunfights and whatnot. And I liked it because each of them had their fun quirks, but they were all so vastly different from mm-hmm. each other.
Yeah. And Phil, you mentioned, you know, it was a twist, so to speak, of having a woman, you know, listen, she was looking for help. And I never looked at that character as a damsel in distress.
No, not at all. Yeah.
You know what? She could handle herself, but she needed help.
Here's the greatest thing of, you know, he's trying to teach her to shoot. And then he gives, I remember, he tells her, if you're going to do this, wear pants. She does neither,
mm-hmm.
and she gets the kill.
Yeah,
and so that was a big moment of, like, you know, obviously at that point, Chris Pratt's character can't see it because he's shot to death. But
wait, what? No,
no, I enjoy that because we're always talking on Anatomy, like how Hollywood is, you know, is slowly becoming has more stories for that, better roles for stronger women in film. And like now knowing that she wasn't really a big character in the original, that she was made bigger in this one, I'm like, I applaud it because she was strong from the get-go. And I like that. And the fact that, yeah, she did come out with a win. And that she was, she supported herself and supported the town because she was even like, I'm going to fight too.
Right.
If this guy's going to leave, well, I'll take his place. And right. She had no qualms about it. And I enjoyed that.
But wouldn't it have, you know, like now that we're talking about it, but wouldn't it have made, like, since we are talking about women's roles and movies and like this character really didn't exist in the 1960. There was a very beautiful Latin American actress in the 1960 version, but she was there as part of a misguided love story. But it was 1960. To me, wouldn't it have been, if you are going for that, why not just make that woman part of the Magnificent Seven? Just make her part of the Magnificent Seven. Like, yeah. Does it have to be all men? Like, if you're going to go that route and take pride in going that route, then go full boat. Just make her part of the Magnificent Seven.
Well,
Magnificent
Eight. No, just make her part of the Magnificent Seven. Just make her one of those. Just take out one of those characters, and
the reason I don't mind it is she's the one that gets it started.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. she understands her limitations, but she's willing to, despite that, kind of go beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then she sort of learns and whatnot. So I don't know. I actually think this is, I don't know, for me, stronger than if she just was part of the Seven. You know. Because she also, in a way, grows.
Yeah.
She had it to begin with, but now she's utilizing what she did have to begin mm-hmm. with. So.
Yeah.
Otherwise, she could have been one of the people dead.
Could have been.
We didn't want sure. that.
No. Not she after survives. What she suffered. No.
Yeah, I was, you know, I was not happy with the beginning of the film. Burning down a church and killing Matt Bomer in the first 5 minutes
before the opening
title credits. I'm like, I'm not sure if I'm gonna like this film.
And he makes it in the opening credits, and you're like, oh well, yeah, so sorry, like, Matt Bomer. So, you know, no. We hardly knew ye. Yeah. It's like, yeah. But you got credit in the, like, opening credits.
You kill Matt Bomer in the first 5 minutes. Like, nope.
Well, not cool. I mean, it's certainly, you know, it's one of those things, you, especially in a Western, that's one of the tropes. You have to set up your villain in the worst of ways.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he was dastardly.
Yeah. He was dastardly. Yeah. Absolutely. But again, I'll say that one thing that the original setup, or the original, the 1960 version set up, is that these townspeople were pretty simple. They didn't know how to use a gun. The only weapons they really had were their shovels, their spades, their axes, whatever. And
alcohol.
And alcohol. You know, and this one, like, in the 1960 version, they were almost chided for not, like, having weaponry. You know, but there was a great key scene in the movie where their shovels came into great use in beating up on the bad guys. And there was a good scene in this movie as well that sort of mirrored that same scene. But, yeah, it's one, again, it's just another trope. It's like the training session, which is, it's a fun part to this movie as well.
Oh, absolutely. And that's where Ethan's Hawke character gets, the fact that he's being questioned and, whether or not he can actually still shoot. And then he just does it. That was a great moment, too, because it worked on so many different levels. So that was a lot of fun to see. Let's see. What else? It's so simple. But why don't we talk about the takeover of the town, the initial one? Because that was a lot of fun. That one was a lot more, of an even fight, let's say. Mm-hmm. And I loved the whole idea of, like, how many did you shoot? Mm-hmm. I got 6. Yeah. Well, I got 7.
Yeah. That kind of reminded me of Lord of the Rings at the end.
Sure.
How they're always counting how many they got. I enjoyed it because, like you said, it was equal, but watching it, I forgot, how many people were originally there. I was like, oh, I guess there were 20 or something, And it was, a nice setup to what the big taking back the town scene was. What I liked, it was quick and fast.
Yeah.
And that they still had one guy left that they let walk away to mm-hmm. give that message. I was like, okay, not everyone just died.
Yeah.
It's like they have some consciousness. They know right and wrong. They're not just mercilessly killing everyone.
No, they're sending a message. No, that's the Western way.
Yeah.
So you leave one to deliver the message.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to deliver it yourself. No. That'd be stupid. No. Come on.
Don't kill the messenger.
Absolutely.
No, you always, number one, always leave a messenger. Number two, always kill the messenger.
Always kill the messenger.
Especially when he's responsible.
Yeah.
Because this was the sheriff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's your symbol.
Still elected sheriff. Not anymore.
But I did love Bartholomew's kind of, no one's going to remember Rose Creek, but they are going to remember me.
Yeah.
And as sick and twisted as that was, I was like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. He played a really, he was dastardly. The only thing he was missing was his little handlebar mustache to twist. But he was dastardly. It's the only word that I can think of. He was that almost stereotypical Western trope of the villain. He wore black. Yeah. He could care less about anything else,
And couldn't help
himself
at the end.
And he took over the church, yeah.
At the end, my joke was like, oh, is he going to change? Is he going to change? And I knew he wouldn't, but he was just setting himself up to, get him, and then boom, the gun.
Yeah, and to me, though, that ending was, come on, is Denzel Washington's character, he's got to know that he's got, Denzel probably has something in his boot. Why wouldn't he think that this guy had something in, if he's had history with this guy. I get the setup and why it ended up being, why it was what it was. Mm-hmm. So it was fine. It was all good. The other thing that I really, we talked about a little bit about the production design, but we also have to talk about the training action and stunts in this movie, I think. Because
they
didn't
want to
really
do CG.
No.
Well, just really quickly, too, even before, just the horrors of shooting this, again, to talk about realism, they would have to wait for, windstorms to calm down and all this stuff. So they're just sitting out there okay, well, when it calms down, we'll go shoot. But, yes, go ahead to the actual training portion of it.
Yeah, I just find that, he basically, they hone their actors to whatever their comfort zone was in doing and handling their weaponry or whatever. And then they would hone in on, okay, this is this guy's specialty. This is how Denzel is and the way he carries his gun. This is the way Chris Pratt is going to be. And I really did like the way that, as far as training goes, as far as, they actually went back to Western history. They used stunt coordinators and such who were working with the greats like John Wayne and stuff and who could ride horses. And the men, the Magnificent Seven, were bonding over what they were learning. It was almost like those summer camps where you go...
Western summer camp.
Yeah, it was almost like city slickers, in a way, where they were learning how to become, like, cowboys. And, yeah, Thel Reed, he was a quick draw expert who toured with Gene Autry, you know, and he worked on Gunsmoke. And you know, he helped Chris Pratt through, and, you know, he showed him how to really use that Colt revolver and things, but I, you know, you
and
get
Chris
the Pratt's
sense. An outdoorsman too, so he must have been loving this. He loves to catch his own fish.
It's the reason why he did it.
Yeah.
He was like, I want to be part of a Western. He goes, this is fantastic. He goes, I would love to learn how to do all this stuff. But everybody, in a sense, yeah. came up, you know, they committed. And, you know, Foucault was talking of say, Chisholm or Denzel Washington. He's like, yeah, Denzel likes to box. You know, so basically I used those strengths to bring that out in him. He was very precise. He only needed one gun. You know, he would be jabbing. Like, he used that. Pratt was a little bit different. The gentleman who played the Red Harvest, you know, he said that his bow and arrow training and rifle training does everything. He shoots bows, guns, and I guess he had a little bit of experience of shooting a bow and arrow, but, you know, going to the gym and just learning how to do all this stuff, to me, it's a testament to the actors and to the stunt people because it really looked second nature to them. No. You know, they looked very comfortable and behind wielding the weapons that they did. You know, my only thing with the Chris Pratt character, I'm going to bring this up, I wasn't buying this whole card trick magic stuff. Like, there was that one scene where those two guys sort of kind of shanghaied him.
At the beginning?
Yeah, at the beginning. I'm like, oh, is he going to, is this, like, and again, Steve McQueen would have never had to, like, rely on a magic trick to get himself out of the thing. But
like I said, I didn't mind that because it played into kind of Chris Pratt. I mean, you know, take his, Guardians of the Galaxy is that his, you know, he's a hero, but he's cocky, but he's not really that cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't mind it in that way. In fact, I wish they utilized it more because that's, to me, what he's great at. No.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mind it either. For me, it established that his character was more fun and playful. And can also at the same time be deceiving. So, but I liked it, and I think it's set up for like a bigger thing that he did at the end.
Yeah.
So
deceiving. The other thing too about this movie is, you know, one thing about Westerns, there's always people falling either through a glass window in a saloon, from a rooftop, and or a horse, and it's how that's done, you know, And the other great thing, too, is they had that great scene with Denzel and his horse. And then he goes on to the side of his horse while he's shooting. That's another great Western kind of stunt, you know, that I love that this movie utilized that old school kind of gunfight. And, you know, the other thing they did a lot was guy goes in through the saloon door and the camera pans to the window. Another guy comes out the window. You know, yeah. They did that a couple of times as well. So call it cliche, but I don't know. I sort of find that fun.
Yeah, no.
I know what I'm looking at.
I do. And, of course, we have to talk about the costuming. You know, seven different types of looks overall. And we talked about sort of the darks for Bartholomew. But these guys, you know, if you know, just even looking at this picture, they're not, you know, they kind of have their own style. They're not necessarily dressed in white.
No.
But shirt-wise, perhaps a little bit more. And, I love their style.
Yeah, Sharon Davies, who is the costume designer, said she wanted to combine a little spaghetti westernish with the realistic look. Now, there was a scene where our Magnificent Seven were either riding into town and whatnot, and Chris Pratt's on his horse. And I swear, I was like, he looks like he's wearing Clint Eastwood's costume and like the Good, the Bad, the Ugly. He's got not the big cowboy hat, but the smaller hat. He had this small type of cigar that Clint Eastwood smoked, and he had on that like black vest or punk. Like, he looked as if he just did walk out of a Clint Eastwood, Sergio Leone, Western. So I get that. So I just found that, you know, Denzel had done a lot of research on the time period, and just, he wore black the person didn't buy the actual print, inspired to look with the texture and layers and just how they looked. That's another thing. The 1960 version, our gunslinger played by Yul Brynner, was also all in black as well. And it's a sign of the times, too, because it makes it a little darker. There's, again, they were not heroes, so to speak, but, you know, and by wearing black, you're not, like, there's a little bit something going on here, but Yul Brynner made it iconic, so much iconic, that when he was asked to do Westworld, the movie by Michael Crichton based off his book and such, the costume that they gave him was pretty much identical to what he was in The Magnificent Seven, and where he was the hero in Magnificent Seven in Westworld, he was the very scary, daunting villain to run away from. And I just found that that juxtapositioning and what they did in Westworld was a nice homage to his gunslinger from the 60s version. But the costumes are great, especially Vincent D'Onofrio.
Yeah, he was.
He looked like a bear.
He did. He was fun, and the way they were, even just the way they utilized him for jokes through both physical and otherwise. Yeah, I mean, it was like one big boys camp, and I loved that about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I liked him, and he had his moment at the end too. I was like, aw.
See, but was it a moment other than just dying? Like, he didn't.
Well, like, it was a moment where...
I just felt...
All he did was die. Like, he didn't even get anything. I wanted more. Like, he was such... He was this bear. And...
He tried,
but... I wanted more out of the kid because he was a character that I really enjoyed watching on screen, mm-hmm. You know? Even his affectation, the way he talked. I loved how they introduced his character, when they find him. I just wish, you know, he more or less
did something.
Died, and he was, you know, and I was like, I was hoping he would at least make it. Mm-hmm. Put his arms around the guy, like a bear. Like, not give up. Like that bear in Revenant. You know?
Die.
So he just wouldn't die. So, I also liked, you know, the costuming of Red Harvest.
He looked fantastic.
It was, yeah, he almost looked like he came out of, like, Mad Max Fury Road.
He looked cool.
He looked cool.
Like, I liked his appearance because he did look so vastly different from everybody else, and, like, you could actually pick him out of a crowd with the with the red. But, you know, going, because we're talking about wardrobes, and I'm, like, watching this film, I'm like, how can they tell that that's their friend and who they're shooting, right. Or a townsperson that they're rooting, or that's trying to take back the town, or a bad guy?
Yeah.
I'm like, how can they equally distinguish who's good and who's bad?
Yeah. Well, here's an interesting trivia piece, too, about the costuming, specifically the hats, mm-hmm. which, you know, can make or break a cowboy. Absolutely. You know, each actor needed to try on at least 15 to 20 hats before finding the one that they felt was best for their character. Mm-hmm. So I find that interesting as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it must have been, you know, and it must have been, and again, I just, there was one thing about this movie that I did sense a camaraderie among these guys.
Absolutely.
So...
And you know, I mean, you know, they've worked together before.
Sure.
D'Onofrio and Pratt, they worked together. Hawk and Washington worked together, and of course Foucault, they worked, like, so there's enough just chemistry from a production standpoint that they were good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of, come on, James Horner, who did the score.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, semi did the score technically, I guess. He passed away back in 2015, so this is his third posthumous score.
Mm-hmm.
Before we started, I joked about it didn't quite have the Magnificent Seven orchestral theme that we've grown to know and love, but I guess Dimitri has a much more keener ear. Than I do, because you heard remnants of it.
Oh, throughout the entire movie. I mean, I was waiting for the movie to open up with the score, and that didn't happen.
Until
the very, very end, we got that full orchestral. And I was wondering, were they going to completely forego? But then as the movie went on, whether they were on their journey, you heard it through other rhythmic instruments. It, to me, it sounded like a like a timpani type of very deep bass type drum where they had the cadence of boom, 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 boom. That was a prevalent thematic score throughout the entire movie that built up until we got that score at the end. Now, I had only wished that the movie had lived up to and built up to that end score, because that to me was one of my favorite parts of the movie, because not only do you have this iconic piece of wonderful music, right? Great score, but you had the way that they did the seven. Yeah. And I was like, that, if only, like, if the movie could have lived up to that, to me, it would have been a really, really big win, because I love the imagery at the end, because they actually paid homage to one of these 1960 Magnificent Seven, where they had the seven and their faces were in the seven, much like in the end of the movie, which I thought was really cool. And then you hear that. You hear that score. But it was really interesting, because they were doing Southpaw, and Fuqua was talking to Horner about Magnificent Seven, and he wanted him to at least read the script and whatnot. And, you know, he had passed away later that summer, and he's, you know, the way Fuqua tells the story, he says, while we were shooting, I got a call that James left a gift for you. And he goes, I didn't know what it was. I thought maybe he had bought something for me related to Southpaw, of all things. And then Simon Franklin, Horner's longtime programmer and arranger, came to the set with that gift, and it was a suite of themes for the Magnificent Seven. And James wrote these themes for Magnificent Seven, and he wrote them off the script. Yeah. And, you know, he goes, the movie may not have ever even happened at that point, because that's how, it was just conversation. And they had a script, and he just said, here, I've already got,
I mean, can you imagine, that's like the world's best gift.
Oh, to compose?
Yeah, to be able to
just
do that.
You know what I mean? Just that notion alone, you know, it's tragic that someone like that passes away, but that, you know, in their own little way, that they've left you this gift. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, to your point, like, okay, it could have been a watch for all I know. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, okay, that's a decent gift, fine, whatever, but this just goes so many things beyond that.
Yeah, he was thinking ahead, and he goes, you know, I was reading the script, and he put this down for him. And, like, again, the movie could have never happened. Like, they could have pulled the plug. They said, a Western, whatever, you know? So, and then this gentleman, Franklin, he completed the score and doing his best to base it off the work that Horner had started. So, you know, Horner has left, you know, an amazing legacy of movies. And he's worked with greats, whether it's, you know, he's worked in the Star Trek franchise, he's worked with James Cameron, whether it be for Aliens or even Avatar and such, and Fuqua, obviously, you know, he has a legacy of music, you know, behind him, and he was a very talented and gifted composer, and, you know, it is, to me, it is a gift, it's a talent to do, you know, that's why I love listening to score, and when we've had John Ottman, and we had Christopher Lennertsen. Like, I love hearing how they approach movies and the cadence. And because I really do think that, you know, there are some times where a score can overpower a movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's got to be a perfect balance somewhere in there. And it would have been very interesting to talk to James Horner or even Franklin and say, okay, why didn't you open up with the Magnificent Seven theme? Like, why wasn't that? Like, what was, like, I want to know what the thought process is. It was throughout the movie, if you could pick it up, and it only showed up at the end. You know, it seems like that was a conscious decision to do.
I mean, if I had to guess, and if you guys disagree, let me know and let me know why, hopefully. But it's so iconic that then you would have, then the movie, I don't know if it ever would have lived up to it. Maybe. We're kind of saying that, you know, but
yeah, you're right.
How do you come back from that and let it sort of have its own merit?
Yeah.
I think also at the end, there were better end title sequence credits that like also help match and enhance the music itself that's already well established. Sure. And people know the music, but it was more even visually better enforced.
Sure.
With the better title credits at the end.
Agreed.
Which made it more memorable, and I think it, like, you know, ended the movie on a better note.
Yeah.
Or on a high note, really.
It ended it impactful. It ended it with that great score, so at least with that, knowing that and seeing that, I did walk out going, all right, that was cool. You know, it was, I'm glad that it was there. Like, you can't forgo it. But I just wanted to see how they were going to bring it to incorporate.
Well, let's talk about the, you know, Marissa, well, I forget, did you say you didn't have a lot of knowledge going into it, or you weren't looking for it? Because for this movie, because I think it's ironic, because I had, like, for months on end, all I kept seeing was Magnificent Seven everywhere. And maybe it's because I'm a guy, and they knew how to market to me. I mean, between the NBA Finals, the Summer Olympics, football, baseball, you know, and all, like, the American Horror Story, Voice, Empire, Walking Dead, like, all these shows that, yes, women do watch, but I don't know. And I just saw it.
I knew, because I'm a big fan of NBA, and I'm a big fan of the Olympics, so I definitely saw commercials upon commercials of this movie, and, like, I knew that this particular year, 2016, there was, like, a bunch of fun westerns coming out, and like, Magnificent Seven, Hateful Eight, and then you even had the Terrible Ridiculous Six, you know, like, all these planned just western movies, so I knew about this movie for a while, and it has a big studded cast.
Yeah.
You have Chris Pratt and Denzel Washington, plus everyone else, and Vincent D'Onofrio, like
Ethan Hawke. Those,
yeah, like we have big names, people who have big followings. You're just going to know what their upcoming projects are going to be. And I think, like, I knew this whole summer that this film was coming out. Yeah. It was one of the last ones to come out to end the summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a movie that, I mean, you know, from a marketing standpoint, yes, I knew it was coming out. you know, and I was looking forward to it. You know, there are people who work together with various directors, you know, and they'll admit it, you know, and Denzel works great with Fuqua. I mean, he really does. Yeah, like, absolutely. Regarding whether it's a serial, like, whether it's a Training Day movie, or whether it's Equalizer, whether it's Magnificent Seven, you know, they get one another, and you can tell, too, like, it was fun seeing Denzel and Ethan Hawke together again, you know? I just think it would have been a fascinating set to be a part of, to see these guys working together. But I think that when there is that comfort level with your director, you know, that helps as well. Like, and again, regardless of, you know, what I believe in Denzel's performance or not, like I said, it was not a horrible performance whatsoever, you know, and he is simpatico with Anton Fuqua, and, you know, hopefully they'll make some more movies together.
Oh, I think they
you
will.
Know, I think they work good. I think they work good together. Yeah. And they make money. They like, do. their movies do well.
Well, you know, part of it, like Lone Ranger and Cowboys and Aliens, those just cost a crap ton of money. And sure. So, I don't know why. Obviously, they're supposed to be, well, Cowboys and Aliens,
visual
obviously.
Effects.
Not necessarily that quite of a Western, but the, you know, this one's made, you know, it's made for over $100 million, but compared to those movies were over $200 million.
Yeah.
So, you know, this will make its money back, and it's already proven in terms of Denzel, it's his third highest opening, it's Fuqua's second highest opening, so, you know, they are well on their way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it opens up around $35 million, and I was doing a little bit of research, and when you look at movies of recent, like, Westerns, like even a True Grit, Django Unchained, and such, like, those movies opened up around the same range, and they each topped over $100 million. So, you know, I think Magnificent Seven, you know, if you're following history, and you're following a track that it's on, it could potentially reach $100 million, depending on what the competition is upcoming. And, they're, you know, I mean, it's got an A- via CinemaScore, so audiences appear to enjoy it. Denzel, we've said it before, and it's nothing new. He is a star. Like, people like him. Like, and he crosses over, you know? People like to see him on screen, mm-hmm. whether he's in Training Day playing like a bad guy, or whether he's in The Equalizer or Magnificent Seven or The Gangster. People like him. When you're partnering and you're able to say things like, from the people that brought you The Equalizer, you know, I think people enjoy that. The other thing that they did well in marketing this movie is that they made it action oriented. And people like to see Denzel in those kinds of movies. When he's in a more serious movie, obviously the marketing is much different, but there's a charisma about him that even if it's a drama, they're going to watch him. They audiences, like, he is a bona fide star that can open up a movie.
Absolutely.
You know?
I agree. He just has, you know, I don't know actually know how tall he is, but he just has that great physical presence. He
does. Gravitas.
You know? Gravitas.
And Will Smith is a star too, but, you know, still, I think, like, you know, there's a humor side to Will, whereas Denzel just, I don't know. I buy the seriousness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool factor.
Yeah.
He's an excellent motivational speaker.
Is he?
If you've ever
heard
any of his speeches, he's amazing. There are some moments I would listen to his speeches just to get me going.
that's awesome.
Yeah, no, he's great.
That's great.
Speaker. Absolutely. Well, before we wrap up, Dimitri promised that he'd tie in Westerns and more specifically Magnificent Seven and what it's managed to do in terms of its legacy.
Yeah, and I also wanted to talk about its legacy, but I also wanted to talk to a little bit about Magnificent Seven, like its history, its track to what we have today. So I find it, because I find this fascinating. So Akira Kurosawa, at the time, was a very huge fan of American cinema, specifically the American Western. And he's like, how can I make, I want to make an American Western. Or a movie that's based here, but I want to use the tropes of an American Western. So he goes out and he makes this movie, The Seven Samurai, which is a classic movie. But that was his ode to the American Western. So Yul Brynner and Walter Murch, who was a honcho at MGM, and John Sturges, Yul Brynner takes it to Sturges and Murch and says, hey, this Akira Kurosawa guy, he made this wonderful movie, and it's supposed to be an ode to American Westerns. I think this is a great movie. How can we make this actually into an American Western? So they go ahead and they do it. And they get people like Steve McQueen and such. And so they make the movie. Now, his version of Seven Samurai, it goes on that Kurosawa was so impressed by the 1960 version of Magnificent Seven that he sent Sturges a ceremonial sword. Like, as a gift. And mind you, at the time that the movie came out, it wasn't like a critical darling or anything. But Kurosawa loved it so much. He was like, here, I'm giving you this sword. And
try
like,
getting that through customs today.
I swear
to God, it's honorable.
So, you know, so I find that, I love that there was like a little bit of a love fest and that American movie making influenced, you know, the East. So, or the West, I should say. So, you know, when we talked about earlier about how the Magnificent Seven continued to, you know, the tropes continue on. But the other great thing that it did, you know, you had the Dirty Dozen, you had Where Eagles Dare. I forgot about Inglourious Bastards. It's the same thing about putting these unlikely people together, right? You know, but then again, the Western became satirized and parodied. Then you had movies like Blazing Saddles, which is, in a sense, you know, a town being taken over by the dastardly villain. And Blazing Saddles is a great satire of the Western and Magnificent Seven. Then you had, of course, the parody of The Three Amigos, which, again, plot for plot, it's the Magnificent Seven, except we get the Magnificent Three, a great comedy. But how Westerns have, throughout American cinema, is just, basically, it's influenced great things like science fiction. Gene Roddenberry, creator of Star Trek, his log line in pitching Star Trek was, it's a wagon train to the stars. Wagon train being a very popular Western on TV. He wanted to take that setting. He wanted to set it up in space. That was his log line to pitch it. And then, of course, There's a little movie that you may have heard of, came out in 1977, called Star Wars. Is basically a Western in space. You look at somebody like Han Solo. If one thing you noticed in here, it's the way Han Solo wore his blaster. He even has the tie around his leg. And, like, think about what Star Wars is about. It's a band of unlikely people getting together to thwart the bad guys. Yeah. And look, you have Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, Ben Kenobi, Han Solo, Chewbacca, R2-D2, C-3PO. You have your Magnificent Seven right there who's going in there. So the Western definitely permeates into American pop culture and influences other genres, you know, by far. And that's what I mean. If you can take the story out and plug it into something else, it's a really good story. It should work in almost any type of genre. We were talking about Easter eggs. We never talked, like, you know, the joke "So Far So Good" is actually a reference to the 1960 version where Steve McQueen's character says that joke when they were in a dire situation. But also, you also had "Down the Horse That Chris Pratt Rode," and this one was the Star of War Horse. Mm-hmm. That's a big horse, by the way. Yeah, that's a big horse. But the other one that I noticed, too, is that Bartholomew, the villain, offers the town folk $20 to get off the land. Now, $20 is what our original band, the 1960 version, $20 was the fee that they were going to get for helping out the townsfolk, beat the bad guys. So, you know, I noticed that one as well. That was sort of interesting.
An interesting too. Nod.
So,
yeah.
An interesting nod. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Fun little things like that.
Well, there you go. Obviously, a very rich history. If you love Westerns, there's definitely no shortage of Westerns for you to check out. And I wish we could cover them all here on Anatomy, and hopefully, as more and more kind of resurface into mainstream, we'll get to do so. But in the meantime, that's about all we got.
It's tough. Well, I was going to mention you and I did a Western a couple of years ago that we thought was much better than a lot of other people did, but it's a Western nonetheless, and it's called A Million Ways to Die in the West.
It was a comedy.
It was a comedy that was a Western that, I mean, he actually used cinematographers who shot Westerns before. It definitely had the look. You know, Blazing Saddles is a Western.
Yeah.
You know, it's a Western. It makes fun of the Western, but it's a Western. You know, Blazing Saddles.
Good point. Absolutely good point. Marissa, any final thoughts from you?
Overall, as not a Western savant, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I would recommend this to people who like Westerns, who like action, and who just like comeback stories, because I feel like this movie encompasses all three of those. And overall, it was just a fun, entertaining movie just to watch throughout the whole thing.
I think Inception has seven people, right? Could be wrong.
Say that again?
Yeah, it could be.
I'd have to break it all down.
Well, there you have it. That's my theory. Prove me wrong. Watch there be six people or eight. I don't know. Anyway, thank you guys for joining us yet again. We truly appreciate the support. Let us know your guys' thoughts, comments, opinions, all that stuff. After all, that's what this is all about, is creating a discussion, not just us talking at you. At DMovies1701.
Yep.
It's been some time since we got to say that.
It's nice to hear. And I want to say again, thanks for the support. And folks, go see... there's some great Westerns out there. Go on to turnerclassicmovies.com or stream some. Mm-hmm. Go on to Netflix. They're really great stories. Check out one of Ridiculous Six.
Not that one.
Or watch something really good, like my favorite, which is The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which great performance from Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne, of course. So check that out in The Searchers, actually. And for you Star Trek fans, The Searchers has Captain Christopher Pike, Jeffrey Hunter is in it, so there's something for you if you're not into big Western. Check it out. I think you will like these movies.
Well, I have my homework cut out for me.
At Serafini TV. The Popcorn Talk. And, of course, shout out to that Zach Wilson in the booth today. He did not see this movie, but you can definitely check him out every week talking about science fiction on Sci-Fi Weekly here on Popcorn Talk. In the meantime, go see other great movies. Check out our past library of content. There's plenty of them, and we'll continue as more and more movies come out. In fact, we're doing Miss Peregrine's house.
Miss Peregrine's home for peculiar children.
And what's the other one?
And Storks.
Storks?
And, yeah. All right, and we'll figure other out how to fun do Storks. Shows.
And some other movies. So definitely stay tuned. See you next time.
See you.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.